Our topic this evening is an extremely interesting one. We call it Personal and Planetary Evolution. This is a class that the content of this class I've actually been teaching for, at least 30 years, because before we ever lived here, maybe 25 years, before we ever lived here in this area, when David and I used to travel up to the Northwest a lot and teach all the same things that we teach now in one place, we used to teach it as a traveling roadshow, I had to try to really think about how to educate people in the whole totality of this teaching, this path of self-realization, which is no small issue, because there's so many different facets that all weave together, and each one of them is an important thread in the tapestry. And at that time, we didn't have centers in the Northwest, and especially in Seattle. David and I would go up there for 3 weeks at a time, a couple of times a year, and then I'd present this whole series of programs, and we'd gradually bring people up to the point where they could become disciples or take Kriya if that was their intention. And of course, when we moved here, we had the same reality, trying to educate people into what it is to be on this path. And so there was a whole segment of it which was about, I used to call this course How the World Works and Why, which maybe was a teeny-weeny bit presumptuous, so we changed it. But the truth of the matter is that's a very good name for it, because there's this dimension of trying to figure out, what is the dynamic of, I don't mean what's happening in like, why does a gas engine work or something like that, but what is the course of how do we make progress? What's going on with the society? Why are we here? Why is everything so incomprehensible, as it often seems to people who end up sitting in classes where I'm talking? Because you don't end up in a room like this about a subject like this unless some part of you inwardly is asking real questions. In fact, recently, as many of you know, we've been trying to discuss in, from every angle we can think of, sort of how to present to people who don't know us who we are in such a way that will cause them to be interested. And we've been advised by people who have professional experience in these things, and we've been following these certain processes, trying to identify, what the benefits of being involved with Ananda are and who our market segment is and all of that, which is an extremely difficult project. I've been working on it ever since I came to Ananda. In one form or another, I've been in the marketing department, so to speak. It's very hard to tell who's really going to be a devotee, because that's who we're looking for, is people. We're happy to help everyone, but above all, we're looking for people who want to be serious. This is not a feels-good kind of teaching. You know, this is a real serious teaching. But the criteria that actually I think Connie came up with it the other night was a real simple one, which is we're looking for people who are ready to think in terms of the inner life, for whom defining life in terms of just the material world and the external reality, it's just not working anymore. And that is actually the unifying factor. They're not necessarily looking for God. They're not necessarily heart-centered people, although being heart-centered and looking for God are fundamental to our path. But when people start out, they're just basically on some level aware that the external world isn't enough and maybe I need to think on a deeper level about what reality is. Often they're very anxious about their inner reality. Sometimes they call it peace. I was talking to my friend Karen Gamow just about that, and we were just comparing notes. From a very young age, really from my earliest memories, basically my desire was for bliss. I called it happiness then because I didn't know the word bliss. But it was happiness I was always looking for. Karen just scoffed like that. Happiness? Who cares about happiness? I was looking for truth like this. You know, that's sort of who she is. But the fact of the matter is we were both doing exactly the same thing, which is that we looked out at the world around us and it just didn't satisfy and it didn't make sense. And the explanations that we were given didn't make a lot of sense. So we started looking for some other dimension that we intuitively knew somehow was inside of ourselves. And That's what's required, and that's also the difference between people who walk in the door and walk out and never come back, and people who walk in the door and then come back in again and come back in again. And pretty soon, as I jokingly said with someone, she said to me, "I'm spending all my time here now." I said, "Well, I know, I see you, you know, every night. I know you can't be anywhere else, even if you're not living in the community," and so on. Because that hunger for the inner life is really fed through what we teach here. Now, the dimensions of self-realization, as Master taught it, Paramhansa Yogananda taught it, and as Swamiji expressed it, are all-encompassing. And that's one of the aspects of the teaching of self-realization, as Master delivered it to America, is that it isn't just a question of, oh, let's take one little tiny piece of life and we'll just sort of work on that, you know, and everything else you do, you can just go ahead and do it. I know when we were first starting the community here, the residence community, all these years ago, at that time, one of the ministers at one of the local churches was an acquaintance of mine from the traveling that I had done before, and we had met him for lunch, and we were told him we were starting a community. I won't say his name or his denomination. He said, "Why on earth would you start a community?" And he basically said, "Don't you think just seeing them on Sundays is enough?" I said, "No, actually, we feel quite differently about it. Besides, it's not enough for them, so to speak. It's not enough for anyone. Because once you start understanding life from the inside out, then it's all pervasive. There's no separation because you're always present. You're always there, so it always has to be dealt with. It can't be just, you know, compartmentalized. But part of what happens when you get on the spiritual path is we begin to think about life in such a different way. It gets very confusing what's going on in society sometimes. And it's very hard to really just make sense out of it. So one of the things that Master brought to us, and he brings this right in Autobiography of a Yogi, he makes reference to, and I say that right in Autobiography of a Yogi because that's really the introductory text. Things get much more detailed after that. But right in Autobiography of a Yogi, he brings up a very important principle, which is he talks about the ages of evolution on the planet, the evolutionary ages of the planet, the ages through which civilizations on this planet pass through. Well, before I get to that, that's a key element, what I was going to say. Let me just finish more in this introductory way. The reason I finally decided to change the name of this is because the title we're using now, Personal and Planetary Evolution, I think is a little more accurate and also somewhat intriguing, at least to my ears, about what this is about. So let me give you an overview. We have 4 weeks, so we're not going to be able to cover everything at once. On one hand, we have this world that we live in, and we have the society that we live in, and we certainly live in interesting times. You know, there's so much going on the planet, and not all of it is, especially nowadays, is very comforting. We have violence in so many areas of the world. We have uncertainty in so many areas of the world, and this sort of violence lying just under the surface. For some reason, it's epitomized to me by the country of Kenya, partly because our friend John, who's usually here on Tuesdays, I don't see him tonight. Our friend John is from Kenya, and I've never been to that country, but all of us are simple-minded enough. I observe from the news I'm not the only one who thought of Kenya as a fairly stable place, but just it was a tinderbox like so many other places in the world. You know, corruption and then just senseless violence. There's just this veneer of civilization on this planet, it seems, and it doesn't take much. And such irrational. You know, they killed Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan, so people set cars on fire and smash banks and things. I mean, like, what is the relationship? The relationship is just an excuse for this pent-up violence to come forward. And now, of course, the economy doesn't look so cheery, and I don't want to just send you home screaming from this room. My goal is to cheer you up, ultimately. But the point is, there it all is. And it's very easy to try to comfort yourself by saying, well, I'll just do Kriya, You know, I'll just meditate and everything will be fine. But most of us are a little too attached to our bodies and our lifestyle and our loved ones to feel entirely comfortable with that thought. We're naturally concerned. So the question comes up very much, what's going on in this world? And you can look at it from a political point of view. It was sort of fun tonight because the intersection over here, it became the gathering point for all the people who were enthusiastic about one candidate or another, and everybody was sort of partying out there with their political signs. I thought it was just fun. Who cares? Remember when the World Soccer Cup was here in Palo Alto and Brazil was playing? I mean, and the Brazilians are just such a happy, party-loving people that the whole town just changed because there were all these Brazilians whose concept of a good time was to hit the streets, you know? They couldn't believe that they were the only ones out there, and they couldn't believe how early everyone went to bed. And you just kind of... But it just changed the whole atmosphere. It was really fun, you know? And who cares if it was soccer or whatever it was? It was just... So it was sort of a happy moment here. But most of the time, it's very puzzling. And yet, at the same time, you have all these indicators, and you have all these people pronouncing the fact that we're entering a new age. And self-evidently, when you look around this planet, just even within the memory of the people sitting in this room, the whole place is just transforming. You know, this business of email, and what to speak of faxes, which seem absolutely arcane by now, but faxes were a really exciting thing when you put the fax in at one end and you knew somebody on the other side of the world was going to read what you were putting in, but there was still a piece of paper involved. Now you just type and send, and because Ananda's worldwide, I have friends all over the world, and I mean, I just talk to them as easily as I talk to someone. In fact, I email people next door all the time. We're talking by email. I mean, we could open our windows and just speak to each other, but we're just sending the email. Sometimes when I'm talking to Karen, particularly on the phone, or Joe, whose houses are just right there, you know, I'm standing on my balcony looking at their house, and they're inside their house talking on their phone. Maybe that's silly. But the point being, it's just like, 25 years ago, when Swami Kriyananda went to India in 1977, after he finished riding the path, he went to Kashmir, as it was, and spent several months in seclusion. And I was responsible for the publication of his book, for the production of his book. So we were typesetting and getting that book out. And I was in touch with him, and we actually had to write letters. We wrote these long letters on airmail paper, and it took so long to get there. And then they'd get out of sequence, and he'd be answering. And I mean, it was just... And then every once in a while, we'd take a phone call, and we could hardly hear each other, and it cost a fortune. And, you know, it's just like, it just seems, how quaint. But it was a very short period of time ago. And that's all, it's symptomatic of a lot of different things, because all of that begins to change everyone's relationship to this planet. I know when America was bombing Yugoslavia, for whatever reason we bombed Yugoslavia, which is a little obscure to me at the moment. First of all, as Tom Friedman points out, it was the first time that two countries that both had McDonald's were at war with each other. His scientific view of the world was that no countries that both had McDonald's ever went to war with each other. So that was a big change on the planet. And the second thing was, this was literally happening. The children, young people, in both countries were emailing each other. And it's like essentially one child's father was dropping the bomb on the other child's family, and they could talk to each other on the email while it was happening. Well, you can see, even though we're still managing to drop bombs on each other, that's not going to go on a lot longer, because it requires a certain demonizing of the other to really be able to treat them that way. I mean, I know there are countries in the world where they're mashing each other up with machetes, so eye-to-eye contact is not necessarily the answer, but still, a whole lot is changing. So we have this whole planetary view, which is both beautifully upward-moving and utterly terrifyingly disintegrating, and we're sort of living in the middle of it all the time, and you just think, like, what is going on here? And then simultaneously, we have the project, which is much dearer to our hearts, really, even though we all definitely have a great concern for the planet as a whole, but that concern for the planet as a whole begins right where we're standing, and it's dear to our hearts because it is our own heart. Just that's what's concerning us. We wonder, who am I? Where am I going? How do I fit into this? And all this chaos around us, or this uncertainty around us, you know, doesn't make for a calm, easy understanding of self or a calm, easy expectation. And we have that whole question, what should I do? What is the proper response for me personally? And there's lots of stock answers. Trust in God. It's all a dream anyway. Just meditate. Don't worry. Don't worry. Be happy. You know, act locally, think globally. I mean, all these different things that people can say. But between the ideal and the capacity to really embrace it and act on it, sometimes, realistically speaking, there's a gap. Now, my experience of this path, and this path meaning what Master brought to America, and the way Swami Kriyananda has articulated it, and then the way it's been lived in the Ananda communities, and I say this not to be sectarian, but just simply to be factual, in all these years that I've been involved with this, which is really, well, it's just getting pretty close to 40 years, I haven't found a question that isn't capable of being answered by Master's teachings. I know that's quite a very big statement, because he was an avatar, and he was an avatar for a whole new age on the planet. That doesn't mean that he was greater, and therefore we should, you know, think of him above all the others. It just simply means he had a particular work to do. And as I'm going to start talking about tonight, we are in an enormous transition as a planet, and Yogananda, among others, but he's one of those who has real spiritual responsibility for this planet. And so he came to not only to inspire a few direct disciples, and not only to inspire a few disciples with the fundamental message of God realization, but also, like various avatars before him, notably Christ being one of them, and Buddha also, to reorient the whole direction of this planet, because this is a time when the planet is in a transition and it's possible for things to change. Now, the other aspect of this, and the other reason why I developed this class so many years ago and why I still enjoy teaching it so much, is that once we start talking about the planet doing certain things, it's natural, although false, for us to sort of identify with the planet. I mean, after all, here we are living on it. In fact, we sort of start thinking that, gee, if this planet's getting better, that there's an almost subconscious thought that that means I'll get better with it. Or even the other thought is, well, since the planet's getting better, I don't necessarily have to put out a lot of energy. I'll just hold on and evolve with it. And I hear many people talking that way. And I hear many people talking about the planet itself as if it were a conscious entity with a soul that we're sort of pushing to evolve. And there's a lot of well-meant but misinformed thoughts that leave us confused. Whereas what Yogananda taught is so exquisite, and I don't just mean it's a good theory, because it's backed up by a lot more than just his own opinion, but it's just so beautiful. And that it really puts to rest all of those questions and helps us really relate to this world and to ourselves in a grounded, solid, practical way that is a service to ourselves and a service to the world around us as we can pass it on. So that is sort of the beginning. What I intend to talk about, and probably more or less sequentially over the 4 weeks that we're here, is, this is 4 weeks, isn't it? Yes. Tonight I want to talk about the yugas, as it's called, which is the evolutionary stages of this planet that it goes through. I also want to talk about karma, what it is and how it works, reincarnation, why we do it, a little bit about the chakras, because the chakras, karma, and reincarnation all get all in swept together, and what it is to evolve spiritually and how you can tell if you're doing it. Okay, and then how that personal acts itself out on the background of the planetary. And this is a great class for questions. So, you know, once we get going, you can chime in. Most of you, for some of you, this material will be relatively new, probably. Others of you have heard it before, at least somewhat. But don't hesitate to chime in. We're just friends. Okay? Is that good enough? Any questions or comments before I go forward? We do record this class, and they end up, usually before too long, posted on the internet. You can also order CDs if you like. We're making a video recording, which we don't exactly distribute in the same way, but nonetheless it exists. So if you don't want to take notes or want to hear it again, usually you can just pick them up, download them later. Okay, so what are we going to do with it? Okay, what I want to talk about now is the planet. There's a common thought that even if we don't even think about it, it has been a common thought. We tend to think of the development of history and the development of man as being more or less a straight line going up. I've always found that before I found Yogananda's theories to be a fairly depressing concept, because that would mean that this is the apex. And, you know, it's hard really to see whether we're going forward or backwards looking around. But we tend to think of history as being a linear process. And there's all this historical data about they find, you know, how things used to be more primitive. And there's also this other evolutionary thought that there used to be apes and then we gradually, you know, got upright and now we stand up straight and strong. And just all of these thoughts that we were dark and we're getting better, and that somehow we're just going to keep getting better. A lot of people's sort of confusion about life is just based on the fact that that thought still leaves you a little bit in dismay. You don't quite know how to work with it. I recall visiting a friend of mine, took me to her church for Christmas, and they had a number of the lay members, you know, not the clergy person, doing readings. And everyone's reading, they wanted to be heartfelt, so they would try to find something poignant. A very perfect example is that wonderful story that appears every Christmas where they talk about the trenches of World War I and how on Christmas Eve someone started singing Silent Night, and then the song spread, you know, throughout the trenches, and then there was a one day of peace and so on. Of course, the end of that was that in 2 days they were trying to blow each other's brains out again, and it just, you know, it was a moment in which life, the lion and the lamb, lay down together, but then it all disintegrated again. And so everyone in this church service, you know, the truth of it was they would just sort of raise this emotional hope, and then out of reality they would just have to dash it, and we'd all just have to sit there and sort of think, oh, if only. And part of that thinking is a much too external view of reality, where if the world outside isn't working, then nothing is working. And also this sort of hopelessness about society, because it just moves a little forward and then it falls back again. And when we get into talking about karma and reincarnation, I'll talk a lot about the different stages of human development and how they all coexist on this planet at the same time, and the absolute futility of trying ever to get this planet really, really organized, at least not for a long time, because it's a heterogeneous planet. It's just a place in which people of widely varying stages of spiritual evolution are all inhabiting the same little piece of turf. And everybody's acting out their own consciousness as well as they can, and many of those consciousnesses conflict with each other, and that's what we're dealing with. Well, instead of this linear view of history, nowadays it's becoming more popular, at least I believe it is, or else I live in a world in which it's more popular. What's becoming more popular is what Yogananda presented in Autobiography of a Yogi, which is not a linear story of evolution, but the tradition of the ages of man, you know, the rising ages of man, the descending ages of man, a circular view of the evolution of this planet. Now, before I say anything else, I want to get this very clear. What I'm going to be talking about is planet Earth. I'm not going to be talking about all of creation or the universes or the galaxies or anything. I'm talking about one planet. We're talking about an actual physical phenomenon that is based on astronomy. It's not even based on astrology. It's based on astronomy, and it has to do with the location of Earth in relation to the what is often called in the Indian tradition the grand central sun, or the center of the galaxy, the point from which the energy that animates our galaxy emanates, and the physical proximity of Earth to that central source of energy, or the distance from it. Okay? So every planet in the universe is living out a different cycle of awareness or lack of awareness based on the amount of energy that that particular planet is receiving at any particular time. Now, what Yogananda describes is he describes a 24,000-year cycle of descending, and I have some charts that I'll pass out to you, and then ascending ages, in which you have an apex of understanding, and then you have a nadir of understanding, and then that apex is gradually lost in a cycle that he specifically expresses, which is an Indian tradition. Then you reach a nadir, and then you gradually begin to reawaken understanding on many different levels. Now, you have an approximation across the board like this of understanding, and I'll explain what that understanding means, that you're having it as people are losing awareness, they gradually get more and more ignorant, and then as people gain awareness again, they come to the same points that were on that side, not necessarily the same souls, but the civilizations on planets as a whole. Now, this whole cycle, which Yogananda describes, which is the tradition, the true tradition of India, is 24,000 years, is based on this astronomical phenomenon of what Yogananda Sri Yukteswar described as an orbit that our planet Earth is in relation to a dual planet. Now, I'm not a scientist on this, and scientific people talk about this all the time. That dual has been suspected by scientists, but has not yet been identified. There's a man named Walter Crittenden who wrote a book called Dark Star? Lost Star, who I send you to his book, which is completely detailed. He's dedicated himself to the search for that lost star. He set up something he calls the Binary Institute because of this concept of the duality. But I'm just going to speak of it as I always have without the benefit of all of that science. But there's just as our Earth is in relationship to the moon and you see all these orbits take place with all the planets that we know about, where planets and their moons move around in set patterns based on the relationship of the gravitational pulls, you know, with a sort of basic scientific facts that we all know, what Yogananda asserts is that our whole system, the Earth, there's a dual to our Earth, and there's a much bigger orbit that's taking place in relationship to that, that's much slower and takes place over a much bigger period of time, that puts us in closer or farther relationship to this grand source of energy, which is the center, the grand central sun, which is my favorite way of calling it. I don't know what it's really called. Nobody knows. Yes, what have I done, Joe?
It's actually the sun that has the whole solar system around another sun.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. I was about to say that. I always get some little fact confused. Thank you for saving me. Okay. The whole solar system is moving around the sun like that. Right. Okay, but this is happening on our Earth because of that. That's what I really mean. Our Earth is being dragged by the sun. It's the sun that has the dual. Okay? So when we're closer to that grand central sun, you know, just at that point, this whole planet becomes greatly energized. And the result of that energizing of this planet is that there is a fundamentally much greater state of awareness. Now, if you think about this, and I'll just put some numbers up, although I'll be more complete in just a moment. This was 500 AD. It's actually 499. I don't know why, but I'm just going to call it 500. When we hit the nadir, there's a little bit of transition. And then in the year 1900, we actually changed into a higher age right here. Now, what happened around all this time, you know, at the end of the 1800s, 1900s, 1700s, there was all this sudden invention taking place, wasn't there? And in this whole year, 1900 up to 2000, you know, and now into this century, I mean, just think. That was an age that started with people driving horses, and it ends up, you know, even before it was over, we're on our way to the moon. Everything, all that I was talking about, all of these electronic devices, and everybody's fond of saying, I can't believe it's actually true, but they all say it, that your wristwatch has more computing power than the computer that sent the first rocket into outer space. I mean, whether it's true or not, I mean, it's just like just such a switch. So much has happened. And what's so fascinating when you stand back and think about it is we say that people invented things, but they didn't invent divine laws. They didn't invent, you know, possibilities of human life that weren't there before. They discovered. They saw things that were always sitting there in front of them that they couldn't see before. You know, it's interesting when you think about it that cars are still, the power of a car is still measured in horsepower. Horsepower. You see what that means? There was an engine came and said, well, what can that do? Oh, it can do the work of three horses. So they called it a three-horsepower energy. You know, we're moving away from images like that, but that was the only way people even had to define what they were looking at. But none of those things were created out of nothing. All of those realities were simply perceived. Why weren't they perceived long before? Now, according to the theory of what the yugas, which is these higher, these ages, as I'll explain in a moment, it's because the planet itself was simply too dull, and therefore, collectively, it wasn't the karma of the planet, because the planet does have a collective karma that we take part in by being attracted to incarnate here, the karma of the planet being what it's inevitably going to do because of its position in the yuga cycles and because of the magnetism it's putting forth and the collection of souls that it draws that just sets certain forces in motion, and that when we choose to affiliate with it, we have embraced that karma, and we've embraced it because it was the right karma for us. This is where the personal and the planetary sort of start working together. Okay. It's because collectively this planet was, it needed to be a darker planet. Now part of that is there's this great sort of cosmic system going on at all times. I'll back into that from another angle. You know, we look around the world we live in right now, and I'm looking at Amintha, who's from South America, and Federico and Luca are from Italy, and I don't see anyone else, obviously, who was born out of this country. But, oh yes, of course, from Guatemala. Who else have I missed? Anyway. But, you know, even though we're all united in many ways, there's still cultural realities that are very, very different. I'm amused when Swami Kriyananda has come to visit here. Often after his programs, he'll greet people, you know, sit here where I'm standing approximately, and he'll greet people who come up to him, and he speaks eight different languages and is really a citizen of the world. And because of where we live, often all eight of those languages and others are all represented. And so many times he'll sit here and he'll greet people. If he perceives that they speak a language, their native language is something he speaks, then he'll talk to them in whatever language is their own. I don't speak anything but English. So I just get to sit next to him and sort of watch the vibrations change. And I'm especially struck, the Italians are the ones that always are the most fun, because I don't know any Italian except I've heard enough to recognize a few words. And when the Americans come, everybody's, of course, very appreciative, but we tend to express our appreciation in a more reserved manner. Oh, sir, I'm so glad that you were here. Thank you so much for coming. Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. I'm glad to see you, Swamiji says. But the Italians walk up, and I don't know what they're saying, but they say something like, ha, 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 ha. And Swami answers, ha, 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 like that. And there's just all this completely other thing that happens. And it's just sort of like, oh, there you are, and I'm so glad that you're there, and yes, I'm so happy to see you and to be here seeing you, seeing me. And it's just like no content, No content, but just this very completely different energy. The Indians yet bring yet another sort of very non-rational, very intuitive, not quite as outgoing, not as flowing as the Italians, but different than the Americans. Now, all of those realities exist on this planet because souls need to put on bodies that give them opportunities to express what we're going to express. And we orient, or we have a certain orientation, and I'll talk more about this in the weeks that come, that just needs to be fulfilled in a certain way. Swamiji, many of you know the energization exercises which Yogananda taught, and which involve using your willpower to train your will by creating physical tension in your body and then consciously relaxing it. Usually, Swamiji says, he always teaches that tense as hard as you can. He said, but never when he's in Austria or Germany. He never tells the Germans to tense as hard as you can because they could just break their own bodies with their willpower. You know, you just never would say that to them. You know, in India, you have to really tell them to tense as hard as you can because they have a much more lackadaisical attitude toward things. You know, it's just everybody's different. But the soul seeks a place that's appropriate for whatever it is. So we live on one planet, we can see it, where there's all these different possibilities of being different ways. And as I said, I'll explain this more, but we choose what we need to learn next, what we're comfortable with or what we're uncomfortable with, but whatever it is what we need to learn next. Well, everything in the universe is consistent. I mean, it's consistent in little ways, it's consistent in big ways, and so God has made this enormous creation, and there's all kinds of planets out there. Master just says all this business about UFOs and intelligent life on other planets. Master's answer is, of course! He says the universe is teeming with life, is how he put it. He said, of course it's true. And when Swamiji asked Master if we always incarnate on this planet, Master said, oh no. His actual answer was intriguing. You'd figure it out too fast, he said, if you just came to the same planet, reincarnated all the time. He said, there's countless planets to go to. Now, part of what that's about is that different planets at different time, and for example, the whole solar system that's related to our sun's dual, okay, it's dragging a whole group of planets in the opposite direction as ours. And all the people who incarnated on this planet at this time to be scientists and to do that whole thing. Years ago, before we came here, David and I had the use of a motorhome. We took this long trip and we ended up in Houston, Texas. Went from Seattle down to Houston and did all these lectures that I was talking about, teaching this class, among others. We ended up in Houston. It was the end of our trip. And so we took a little tourist trip to Mission Control, NASA headquarters there in Houston. And I had never, you know, I, like everyone else, have been fascinated by what we've accomplished, but I have, as you can see, I couldn't even remember that the sun had a dual. It's like, it's not my fort. So I'd never even stepped onto such a place, but I stepped onto that ground, and there was just this enormous sensation that this was another huge karmic family. You know, just like the karmic family of Ananda that I'm so familiar with, that I found so early and have immersed myself in my whole life. Obviously, NASA and all those people who came to put the men on the moon, that's obviously a karmic family. And they're people who are really excited by that, who have that to contribute, whose role, who knows, maybe they travel around the cosmos incarnating on planets that are just ready to start space flight because they're so fascinated by that. And you know, many very inspired people, they spend their whole careers making that happen, and it's a great contribution because look at all, on many so many levels, that all this technology does for us. Somebody has to do it. And I talk sometimes, I meet those people every once in a while, here and there, and you know, they just have a passion for what they're doing, and it's a good thing to be doing. And they find planets where they can do it. And then you have, those people in Kenya, or those people in Pakistan, or I don't mean to speak particularly ill of those countries, so we have the same ones in our countries, who just at the drop of a hat will go smash a car and burn a bank, you know, because that's just kind of what they like to do. And that seems to be what they need to do karmically right now, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later. I don't mean that it's good for them, it's just what they're doing. So they need to be on planets where they can do that sort of thing. And if this planet gets too refined for them, they'll just go find a darker one. But they've managed to sort of share this one with us now, because that's one of the things that's going to happen on this planet now, is a lot of unreasonable violence. Because we're in a transition. And whenever there's transitions, there's always a lot of chaos. Okay, do we have the basic theory in mind here? Is there anybody who has any questions about this? There's a zillion more things that could be said, but... Okay. Yes, Jay. Oh, wait a second. We're going to give you a microphone so that the recording will have your question on it. No, you don't have to stand up. This is actually entirely and only for... More people hear these classes recorded than in present, and they get so upset with me because I don't repeat the questions. So go ahead, Jay.
Well, in keeping with your thought about this group of souls that have come to help us attain space travel, do you think there's a group of souls coming to help us solve the energy crisis?
Solve it or destroy the planet, a little of both. Yes, of course there is. There are, in the sense which I will put up here, because we're going forward. We're going into a new, an age of higher and more subtle understanding, which is actually called the age of energy. So if it's the age of energy, we're definitely not going to run out of energy. I mean, just think about it, you know, it used to be all about horses and serfs. And if there weren't enough serfs and there weren't enough horses, how could you ever get any work done? And I mean, it's just laughable now, isn't it? Because it's all been from technology that nobody could even imagine. So people are just on the edge of beginning to imagine, and they can't make it practical yet, but there was a time when there was no automobile and no airplane travel. And, you know, Fulton's Folly was, what was it, building the boat, you know, that was bound to sink, and the Wright brothers were thought foolish. So yes, of course, there are people who are coming who will solve it, and they'll solve it in ways that will be so obvious when they solve it, but we couldn't see it until then.
Thank you.
Is that, yeah. See, that's one of the things that's reassuring about all of this when we start really putting the picture up here, is that we don't have to worry about all that stuff so much anymore. It's really in God's hands. It's not in ours. I mean, if it's your destiny to worry about it, you really ought to. I meant that differently. I didn't mean to be anxious about it. I meant to have creative solutions for it. That's what I meant by worry about it. I mean, if you insist on being anxious about it, but, you know, anxiety is just inwardly generated, and we just hang it on whatever looks convenient. You know, if we're determined to be anxious, then we'll just lie awake at night and worry about running out of fossil fuel. If we're determined not to be anxious, we won't be. Situations are always neutral. Okay. Well, actually, I don't need to take my circle off, but I already have. So now, the four ages that the yugas describe, or, you know, have been described in many other ways. Sometimes they talk about it, what is it? Iron, brass, silver, and gold. I don't think I have that right. Joe, you always have this bronze. Yeah, I'm just like, I'm the world's worst. It's the oddest thing. You know, like anything that's human, I can remember conversations and who was sitting there from so many years ago. When I wrote that book about Swami, I just knew all that stuff. But I can't remember whether it's bronze or brass, because it just doesn't mean anything to me. It has to have like a personal, there has to be a person in it before I can understand it. Anyway, it's just welcome to my brain. You know, there's a lot of traditions about the ages, and they're always in fours, almost always in fours, because that's just the way that it seems to work. Because there is a truth of it. And see, part of this is, which is what's so fun about it, is that in the highest age, at the apex of this, everybody knows this. And they don't just know it because there's some esoteric group that's taught them. They just look at the world and they just know it. It's just a fact. Everybody does. And then the information gradually gets lost. And then usually it goes into secret and just a few people remember it. And then there's just these little fragments, you know, Plato talks about some of these things. There's a little fragment of this and a fragment of that. And when Biasa teaches this class, which you can also get, I think, through the internet in some way, he does. He talks about all the barbarian hordes that came around during this nadir, burned the libraries, killed everybody who knew anything, and just basically destroyed almost all of human understanding because it had to be the Dark Age. It wouldn't be the Dark Age if we remembered that we were heading up to a Bright Age again. By definition, it had to be that we just, here we are, and we're just sitting here, and this is the way it's always been. Otherwise, it wouldn't be such a Dark Age. Even when Jesus came, which was, you know, around in here, one of the traditions, which I believe is a true tradition, and it's beginning to come out again because we're coming up on the other side, was that Jesus was part of the Essene community, and that the Essene community was a remnant from a higher age that had kept a fragment of more understanding intact. They knew more secrets of astronomy. They knew more secrets of inward communion. There were even stories, and these are all myths, but you don't know what the myths are really based on. They had alternate energy sources, all sorts of odd things that nobody understood anymore or could replicate, but they still knew them because it was some little thread of true tradition had been kept alive, and Jesus stepped into that. Now, mentioning Jesus here, who came 500 years before the nadir of this whole thing, reminds us that we're talking about a planet. And on that planet can incarnate souls of any state of consciousness. Merely because the planet is in a dark place doesn't mean that everybody on the planet is in a dark place. It just means that the all-pervasive consciousness of the planet is lower, and that therefore society is defined as a whole. For example, Jesus was crucified. As we all well know these days, he was nailed to a cross. It was a pretty barbaric thing, no matter how you define it. It was made all the worse because, of course, he was an avatar, and it was just a despicable thing to have happened. But he was one of three who was being crucified that day, and the other two were just ordinary criminals because capital punishment was just really the rage. And they didn't just kill people, they killed them in a gruesome, horrible, public manner. In ways that, you know, we're just horrifying to us even to think about it now. I mean, the whole thing about Christianity has just been having to contemplate that terrible crucifixion. But at the time he was crucified, it wasn't that he was crucified, it was just that he was killed. You see the difference? Because everybody was crucified who was executed. It would just be like they taken him and put him in the electric chair, which is now, as our age rises, we're beginning to think is fairly barbaric too. But the whole culture was such that people could just be crucified, and that's just what happened. And people just didn't rise up in horror against it. But still, there could be a man like Jesus and his 12 disciples on the planet at that time, because personal evolution follows a completely different timetable. And one of the reasons that Jesus incarnated at that point was in order to plant with power some truth that could hold the light through all of this dark period of time. And it was the monasteries, the Christian monasteries, where they had pulled far back from society, because in those days there was no point in really trying to relate to society. It was just too dark. If you were serious about spiritual life, you went into a cloister, you went to a cave, you went to the desert. The monastics drew way back into themselves, and they kept a little remnant of civilization alive until it was time for it to come out again, until St. Francis came, and then the Renaissance began not too long after, and all of it began to open up again, because here we are trailing after our sun, just chugging around the universe, and we're finally getting to the point where we can start pepping up on this place again. Now, other proofs of that have to do with all of the evidences you see of very highly evolved civilizations, which again, in Crittenden's book, Lost Star, really detail all of that. It's not my particular interest, so it's fascinating, but I have trouble keeping this in my mind. I could never keep any of that in my mind. But just look at obvious things. You look at the remnants of the temples in Greece and the Pantheon in Rome, you know, that just extraordinary structure. You look at the pyramids of Egypt, which I've never actually seen with my own eyes, but no one can understand how those pyramids were made. We have the Cecil B. DeMille version, where you have all these poor Jews, you know, dragging those stones But no one who looks at those, they're not made by any normal agency that we can think of. There's not enough horsepower that could have really created what they created. Now, as we're beginning to come up to a higher age, people are beginning to speculate how they were really created. Were those stones moved through the power of thought? Were those stones moved through the power of sound? You know, was it moved through very subtle magnetic forces? You know, no one can quite replicate it yet, but we're at least beginning to imagine how these things can work. I just, not too long ago, some friend of mine had to have kidney stones removed. Not very long ago, somebody would have taken a huge knife and hacked up his body and peeled back his body and reached in and got the kidney stones out. Instead, they put him in a vat of water and they bombarded him with sound waves. You know, he had an ultrasonic treatment to dissolve his kidney stones. I mean, something tiny inside his body was dissolved and the medical problem was solved without ever touching his body, just by sending the sound waves into it. And we just take that for granted. Now all surgeries are done with those little tiny things going inside, or so much of it. None of that was, I mean, see how subtle all that is? Who's to say what the limit of those kinds of powers, those kind of changes could be? It's just that we don't know what they are right now. And they, you know, lots of things just indicate that there were many higher ages besides all those traditions. So I'm not going to like try to persuade you, but you can be persuaded by reading those other books. I keep taking that circle on and off again. The four ages of man, as Sri Yukteswar describes it, is Kali, Dwapara, Treta, I have some handouts that has all this written on it, and Satya. Yuga simply means age. Yuga is a nice word to know. Okay. Kali is the age of matter. Dwapara is the age of energy. Treta is the age, okay, Joe, if I say this wrong, thought, the power of thought. And Satya is the age of the power of spirit. Okay? Now, we are right at the beginning of you are here. But you are right at the very beginning of here. Okay? We are just transitioning from the age of matter into the age of energy. Now, if you just start thinking about the world in those terms, it all gets very much more interesting. What are the characteristics of the age of matter? Well, horsepower to be one. I mean, all the thought of how anything is done has to be done by some physical force, usually generated by the person. I was just reading, you know, just about the feudal system. Our school is doing a play about St. Francis this year, and I was helping with the costumes. I was reading about the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, and about the serfs and how the serfs were just owned by the lords. Their labor was owned, their person was owned. It was just, that was the system, and they had to just work the land. Somebody had to work the land, somebody had to make it happen, and the people with power just took possession of these poor serfs, and they talked about, you know, when you're on the bottom of the food chain, it's always awful. At the bottom of the food chain down there, when the Black Death came through, they were the ones, they died in scores, so many of them died, more than of any other class, but then they still had to keep working the land, so it was still really hard for them. Fewer of them were there to do all that work. I mean, nobody had any ideas of machines or anything like that. It was just, it had to be done by human force, humans and animals, that was it. And on a more subtle level, the nature of the material plane is that things bang against each other. You know, I have this one and I have this one, and they're not the same one. You know, there's just no way. Everything about the material plane is fixed. There's you, there's me, there's the floor, and things just stay the way they are. Matter is fixed. It's like a stone. That's the nature of it. And so it leads to all sorts of other mental attitudes, dogmatic attitudes, that truth is a fixed reality and it's an either-or proposition and everything is seen in physical terms. You know, even religion. It was the age of matter that took the teachings of Jesus and all those beautiful allegorical things, all those beautiful symbolic things, they made them all literal. He He spoke of being the Son of God, so therefore he must have been conceived, he must have been born, you know, God must be his daddy and Mary is his mommy, and, you know, just all this, there was no way that anybody could take any of that and do anything more subtle with it. Because in the world of matter, it's a very either or thing. The deeper meaning of that, which is now being spoken of so often, Son of God, the Anointed of God, the Christ consciousness. No, there was Jesus and it was him. And religion itself, you go, I think it's St. Peter's in Rome. I think that's the place where all the other cathedrals, the size of all the other cathedrals is marked out to show you that St. Peter's is so much bigger. I mean, you walk in at first, it's, first of all, I mean, the whole Vatican, which is the epitome of Kali Yuga religion, is the Vatican, much as I love Italians. I mean, it is just, the first time you go there, first time I went there, you probably feel the same way. All you can say is, golly, it's so big. You know, it's just huge. And it's built to intimidate you. And you're meant to feel that we are powerful and you are not. You know, just like we're big, you're not. It's this very either-or sort of thing. And we show our power by the immensity of our buildings and the power of our stone and the height of our cathedral and the fact that all other cathedrals fit inside our cathedral. Whoa, you just think, and you do think very seriously, that it can't last. That whole consciousness, it just can't go into Dwapara Yuga. And you kind of wonder what's going to, really, literally, what's going to happen to it? Because that very building is antithetical to the direction that we're going. Because that kind of concentrated, we're right, I mean, even just recently, I don't mean to sound funny, but bless his heart, the Pope came out and reminded us all that even though we might give lip service to the idea that other religions have something going for them, sooner or later you have to be a Catholic or it's, you have no hope. You know, like, okay, thanks for telling us that. You know, the people who are devoted to that point of view just think, I didn't know that either, Swami explained it to me because he was living in Italy or he keeps track of these things. He actually said once when we were talking about the problems of the Pope, he just said, well, you know, if he didn't hold the line, he's just going to, the whole thing's going to fall apart. And if he does hold the line, the whole thing's going to fall apart. Yeah. He just said, I'm just glad I'm not the one having to make those decisions, is how he put it. He said, it's just like, people just laugh at it. But you see, there was the time through all of Kali Yuga, you know, it's hard for us to tune into it, how powerfully the Catholic Church could hold people to its point of view because it would threaten to excommunicate them. And if they were excommunicated, they were damned for all eternity. I mean, it's not really something you want to mess with. This life is bad enough, but all eternity to be damned? And that point of view was so powerful. Of course, there were those who just paid no attention to it. But it was not an easy miasma to shake off because in Kali Yuga, everything is very fixed. You're either saved or you're damned. You're either blessed or you're not. You're either accepted or you're excommunicated. Just this very strong force. Now, once you begin to move even a little bit out of the age of matter and you begin to think in terms of energy, and of course Einstein popped right in there at 19, you know, around the 1900s, just when everything was beginning to shift. And he started saying, look, that matter is nothing but energy. And Einstein was born to tell us that. And the fantastic thing about Einstein's revelation is that it was a revelation. He just had it. He just saw it like that. He didn't sit down and reason it out. He just suddenly perceived that matter was energy. And as he explained it, they said it took him 10 years to figure out all the mathematics of it so he could explain it. And then only a few people understood what he was talking about at that point. Yes, Carol.
What does it mean that the ages are similar to our bodies, like our physical body, then our astral body, then the thought is like the causal body, and then the spirit is like...
Carol is making the observation that these ages, you know, physical, mental, or you know, physical and astral and mental, it doesn't quite correspond, but what you're saying is that we're evolving from more gross to more subtle forms. Mm-hmm. The difference is that we hold all of this in our physical body all the time. You know, at any point in this physical body, you can transcend it completely and be completely liberated. The other side of it is that even in the highest age, it's still a material world. This is not the, this never becomes the astral world. It's always the material plane. It's just like now, we're a more refined culture and we no longer have blood sports in the Colosseum and we don't kill people through crucifixion just for stealing a loaf of bread. So it's a more pleasant place here than it would have been for refined people in those age, but it's still the material world. And I was with Swami Kriyananda once and he was in a mood of particular vairagya. Vairagya means detachment from this world, disinclination. Vairagya actually means disinclination for this world. And we were just chatting, and he was making the comment that he really was not inclined to think of reincarnating again. I said, not even in a higher age? And he said, no, he said, it's still the material plane, and people like us never feel like it's home here. And then I said, but he said, the only difference, he said, is that in higher ages, people like us are in charge. That was the word, that's what he said. You know, right now, we're like, just slightly less than utterly dismayed because we have one or two political candidates that are not absolute horrors, right? And maybe we have one that isn't an absolute horror. I don't even know that. But you know, it's like I'm actually for the first time I actually voted. I haven't voted in. I voted for Schwarzenegger because I thought he was so much fun. But I haven't voted for years. In years. But I voted again, and I said to David, I'm actually interested, you know, because usually I just look at the whole political scene and I think, not my world. But Swamiji said, you know, in higher ages, people like us are in charge. I said, so the whole world's like Ananda. He said, yeah. He said, however, it's still the material plane. And so it's never the astral world, and you always want to transcend it. We're all of these at once. That's what I was trying to say. I lost the train. That was the question. In a physical body, you have the capacity to transcend everything and go to infinity no matter what the world is doing. At the Desert Fathers, right at the nadir of civilization, were still having ecstasy. They were just looking at this world. Let me tell you one more funny thing. See, what was the story? I think these are these various stories about these yogis who go into deep states of meditation and are there for such a long period of time. This was one of those where some meditating yogi was excavated out of a cave. And yes, they were digging down into this, and they found this yogi in meditation posture, and he was sitting there. And when he came back to outer consciousness, there's several stories of similar ones, but this man came back to outer consciousness, and he said to the one who brought him back, what yuga is this? And they said, Kali Yuga. He said, oh, I'm not interested. And then he just left his body. And he said, if you dig over there, you'll find the Murti. You'll find the little image of God I was worshiping. And they dug there and they found it. He said, I'm just not interested. You know, it's too gross. If it was Satya Yuga, there would be more saints. I don't know what he would think. Not interested. We laugh sometimes. You know, what kind of a day you were having? Well, I was so disoriented, I couldn't remember what yuga it was. You know, it's like you're really way out there. Did you have a question, Sharmila?
I did.
Do you remember it? Okay.
I was just thinking about, as we're in this ascending age of Dwapara, how parts of this planet Earth definitely seem to be in the pit of Kali Yuga. And it seems like it's just very different from different parts of this planet.
Right. Well, we're in just the very early stages, and we're actually, I guess we're in Dwapara proper, but.
So is it like, I mean, the process of evolving is like, I mean, one part of the planet could be coming along way slower than some other. But when you said that we contain all of this within our person,
right.
So that even in the most materialistic Kali type area, say of the planet, say the country that's butchering each other or whatever, there are still people that are, of course, of higher elevation, higher
right.
consciousness.
It would be wherever they need to be, when we start really talking about karma as on an individual level, wherever you actually need to be. But what, Let me catch what I was going to say. Oh, but the point is that I haven't put the timings up here, but each of these ages is a little bit longer than the one that comes before. Satyayuga is 4,800 years. Treta Yuga is 3,600 years. Dwapara Yuga is 2,400 years. And Kali Yuga is 1,200 years. And each of these has what they call a sandhi, which is a transition period of, a transition period of the age that's ending and the age that's rising. Now, do I have this correct? Somebody help me here. Is this 200 years?
It's 1,000 with 100.
I have it. 1,000 with 100. 200 on either side, right? Is that correct? That's right. That's what it is. So it's 100, right. 100, yes. That includes the transition periods. So you have a couple of centuries of transition. So the point being that before you reach the peak of Dwapara, which is a long ways to go from where we are right now, but what you always have, life is always on the material plane, is always dual. That's the nature of the material plane. Jesus is extremely esoteric. If thine eye be single, thy whole body is full of light. Meaning if you're looking through the spiritual eye, everything unifies in divine light. If you're looking through the two eyes of the physical body, it's always light and dark. It's always pleasure and pain. It's always birth and death. Even in Satya Yuga, it's still the material plane. So there's always going to be the top, there's always going to be a spectrum, a polarity. But what happens is the age moves up. Just talking in the culture as a whole, that the whole thing moves up and the bottom is not so low, but there's still a bottom. But this thing is still just barely beginning to shift. So even in the world, the parts of the world that are still barbaric, they're not as openly and wholeheartedly barbaric, and their barbarism is not embraced by the whole society. It's still like what happened in Rwanda is called a genocide, and it's even though for a time those forces were able to really take force, you know, eventually order was restored and people were punished for what they had done, and this great remorse set in because it still has elements of that, whereas in previous times the barbarians just ran through and then they became in charge and it just nobody even thought about it. So we're definitely in a transition, but we're just at such an early stage. And the other thing that's happening is you have this planetary conflict happening because people resist change. Everything resists change. I mean, nature doesn't make sudden leaps. It just sort of shifts slowly. It evolves slowly. And there's an enormous force of Kali Yuga just still in place on the planet. All these years of habit, all this real estate, all these traditions. I mean, the Vatican is still going really, really strong. And there's a huge, you know, number of people who are still into this kind of thinking, and they're fiercer about it rather than less so, because they're so threatened by this other force that's happening. And what you see right now is the breaking of a whole society in order that a new society can come forward. But a tremendous amount of breaking is going to have to take place. And that's what we have chosen to incarnate into. We have chosen to incarnate at a time when one world is shifting, when the whole world is shifting. Now, another one of these points that took place was when Krishna lived, which was, you know, on the circle. Krishna was about here. Krishna was Dwapara Yuga ending. He was at the same transition point that we're at. Krishna was, an avatar, and he was the Mahabharata. Okay, and he took the world from Dwapara to Kali, but it was going from an age of greater enlightenment to an age of greater and greater darkness. Interestingly, because Yogananda was Arjuna, Krishna was Babaji, and they came at exactly the same transition, and now they're here again, but they're taking it up. Now, what's interesting with Krishna is that Krishna was there, Arjuna was with him, and there was this huge war, the Mahabharata war, in which all of the heroes were destroyed. I mean, everybody was wiped out. And you would think that would be a terrible thing to have happen. And even, there's also points in the story where Krishna, who was assisting the forces of good in this great war, the forces of good were being defeated by the forces of evil. And Arjuna, the great hero, had made this promise. The whole story was that these people had tricked and dishonorably misled his young son, Arjuna's son, Abhimanyu. Yes, I think it was Abhimanyu. And, no, Abhimanyu came later, so I can't remember the name of the son. It doesn't make any difference. But they tricked him, and then they'd surrounded him, and then they'd killed him. And Arjuna swore that before the sun sets on the next day, I will kill this warrior, or I will take my own life, the one responsible for killing my son. Well, the forces of darkness just conspired, and the sun was about to go down, and Krishna and Arjuna was not going to be able to fulfill his vow. So Krishna held the sun in the sky. He stopped the sunset, which gave Arjuna just that extra time, and he was able to do it. Everybody called, foul, foul, how could you do that, Krishna? You, who are supposed to be the incarnation of Dharma, how could you do such a thing? And later on, he told Yudhishthira, who was the head of the foremost of the Pandavas, the good guys. Arjuna was so pure, they said, that his chariot was always a few inches off the ground. He didn't actually go on the ground. He always floated a little above it. And there was this other great hero that had to be defeated. I mean, there's all these allegories that go with these stories, with this other great hero that had to be defeated. He was so powerful, he was just wreaking havoc to Arjuna's and the good guys' forces. And Krishna said, look, if you tell him that his son is dead, he will lose heart and he will not fight anymore. And his son's name was Aswatthama. Krishna said, but he won't believe if anyone tells him. The only person he'll believe who says it, if you say it, Yudhishthira, but Yudhishthira says, it's not true. Aswatthama is a great hero. He's not dead. And he said, well, there's an elephant here who has the same name. We'll kill the elephant. So then Yudhishthira said to Drona, you know, Aswatthama, your son is dead. He turned to Yudhishthira, is that true? And Yudhishthira, Krishna's pushing him from the back. Yudhishthira says, yes, Aswatthama is dead. And then Yudhishthira said, the elephant, like that, the elephant. But Drona believed his son was dead. He laid down his weapons. He didn't fight anymore. And then afterwards, others said, Krishna, how could you do these dishonorable things? He said, Dwapara is over. It's Kali Yuga. He said, in Kali Yuga, evil is so strong that you have to use a little bit of evil to defeat it. I mean, you know, these are just allegories, but Krishna himself came to make it happen because this is the divine plan. You see, the human plan is, let's all be comfortable. Please don't rock my boat. Don't challenge me too much. This is what I want. Why don't you give it to me? Oh, I just love just being in my little house, drinking my tea and having my little garden. You know, and God just, frankly, couldn't care less. He wants us to transcend the whole thing. But our little human idea is this, and then Krishna comes and he just wipes out the whole civilization. He leads the war. You know, it's like Yogananda incarnated as William the Conqueror. It's just a stunning piece of historical fact. And William was a fierce fighter, not as brutal as people have made out, but it was a brutal age. And he was a fierce commander, and he fought. He didn't care if people died. Krishna didn't care if people died. Many, many, many things much more important than individual life and death. Plus, as Krishna said on the field of battle, to Arjuna, who was concerned about everybody dying, Krishna says, you think they die. They don't really die. Their bodies fall down, their spirits rise. Like, what is the big deal here, right? Well, God, it's really big to us. Feels really important to us. So we've chosen another one of those times. We've chosen a time when a whole way of living, a whole culture, has to just be wiped out. I mean, you walk around and you think, this can't go into the future. It's just too old. It's too fixed. Many, many things can't go into the future. America is a Dwapara Yuga country. America was made for Dwapara Yuga according to Dwapara Yuga principles. No caste, no class societies. You know, everybody, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men were created equal endowed by the Creator with the same inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That was such a revolution dedicated to freedom of religion. You can worship any way you want. Speaking again of our Italian friends, when we took Ananda to Italy, we were calling ourselves a church, but you can't call yourself a church in Italy. You just don't start churches. And when we were here buying this building, which used to be Catholic, and a group of our Italian friends were visiting us, we were talking about buying a Catholic church. They were just looking at us like, what could you be talking about? How could you buy? Catholics don't sell their churches. You know, they just are for all eternity. But in America, they do. It's just everything is different in this country. I didn't travel outside of America until I was in my mid-30s, and I didn't understand because this was the only culture I'd ever seen. First, we went to Europe, and then later, I went to India. And my poor Italian friends are coming in for the best and the worst tonight. But I went to Florence. I went to Florence. I just was a naive American. And all these Florentines were so proud of the fact that they were from Florence, you know? I mean, there's the statue of the David and, you know, Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci. And I'm so American, I thought, well, what the heck does that have to do with you? You know, it's like you're nothing. That was them. This is you. And when I went to India, it was even more so. Just all this looking back and all this reflected glory from all this culture that's behind you. I mean, we never, ever think like that in America. You know, in business since 1980, that's really a big old thing in this country. 20 years. And we're always looking forward because there's nothing behind us except some shameful treatment of indigenous peoples and slaves. But there's nothing behind us. We have nothing unless we're going forward. But this country was founded for Dwapara Yuga. I said to Swamiji once, did the same masters that brought self-realization found America? He said, well, they must have been involved. Because you had to have America before you could have this movement of self-realization. Before a master could walk in and say, everybody can realize God. And I'm going to give these teachings to everyone. I mean, even in India, it's very complicated with the castes and all these traditions that people have and this long-standing this and that. I mean, we're trying to bring this teaching back to India now, but it's not that easy. Because there's all this, as I was saying to someone today, all this belief that they already understand it. Whereas in this country, it was a completely clean slate. And we're all just, we think we can do anything. Yogananda put it, he said, in India, they know how hard it is to realize God. In America, they have no idea. So they just thought, sure, why not? You know, we've done all these other things. We can do this too. And he loved that spirit because we're very much a Dwapara Yuga country. That's why it's no accident that America is influencing the world. Oh, you can see, this is why these are all very important thoughts. You can stand back and say, well, yeah, we've done a lot of bad things too. And of course we have, but Master said, overall, America's karma is very good. He said, we have some bad karma. He said, really, we have some bad karma from slavery and from the way we treated the Native Americans. And we will have to pay that karma. Because still, you know, since the Civil War, no war has ever been fought on our soil. You know, other countries have just been devastated, but no war has ever been fought on this soil. And we've been in a positive trajectory economically, just with a little dip here and a little bit there, but I mean, the wealth and the luxury and the comfort and the pleasure seeking that we have in this country is just, well, you can see because the whole world tries to get here. Now they speak ill of us, but they still are beating down our borders to get in because you can really make something of yourself here. It doesn't matter who you are. You know, the merest immigrant can become, well, at least governor of the United States, governor of California, if not of the United States, president of the U.S. I mean, look at Barack Obama. It's just the oddest thing. You know, there he is from just this strange mixture of cultures and rising, and the country's just taking him right in. You know, if there was anything like class or culture or ethnic or anything, such a thing would be unthinkable. But in America, we're just all cheering it on, you know, because that's who we are. But where was all this thought? Oh, yes, but this is what was required in order for this teaching to take hold. And now it's going back, you know, through Ananda, back to Europe, out to India, and it'll just keep going like that through SRF 2, but through Master's Disciples. But it had to start here, where you can start a church.
where you actually can just start a church. This is such a peculiar concept in other places. You just start one. Sure, we start religions all the time, you know? But think about how unusual that is. Because you see, for us, we're not about matter. We've always been about energy. That's why a person can come. You just get off the boat, you have nothing, and you, by the dint of your energy, you can make yourself anything you want to be. Matter is completely mutable in the American consciousness. We're completely dwapara. Isn't it remarkable when you really think about it? I mean, the master was very proud of America, and I don't mean the kind of patriotism that leads to oppression of other peoples. You know, there's a lot of bad things being done in the name of America right now, which is really, really unfortunate. But America is really a remarkable country because it's Dwapara Yuga, more than any other country in the world. And we will set the tone. Master said that India and America together, that's the future. And it has to be the American spirit because that's the Dwapara Yuga spirit. It's not anything about our culture. It's just that we were started for this reason. And that's what we're going to do here. But in the meantime, first we have some bad karma to pay. And the whole world has to shake itself loose. Now, we're talking about something that's going to last more than our lifetimes. This is a few centuries of this sort of thing. And it'll probably get worse before it gets better. And it will probably take cataclysmic form. Master said it would. I think just a lot of stuff has to get wiped out. Because as long as we can just go on this insane pursuit of materialism, we'll just keep doing it. And when we're finally just smashed to bits, and we can't do it anymore, I think there's going to be this rising from the ashes of, boy, am I glad that's over. Whew. You know, this holding two jobs, having five cars, and, you know, just spending thousands and thousands of dollars on vacations and children's clothes, and, you know, just like, and finally, we won't be able to do it anymore. And then we'll come back to energy. We'll come back to really what's really real for us. Because part of what's happening, too, is you have Dwapara Yuga energy in Kali Yuga consciousness. So you have billions of laws and the new tax codes and, you know, everything is just, all this energy just is taking form and multiplying it like crazy. But, it can't hold it. It's going to have to shift into something that's more for us. Well, anything else? Should we sing God Bless America? That's what I feel like. That's what I was leading up to. You know, I don't have a shred of national sectarianism in me, but I have now in my life traveled quite a bit, even though I've never lived in another country and I don't speak any other languages. The more I travel, the more I appreciate what we have here. For this reason, for the Dwapara Yuga reason. And that's just to say that we were born for this, and so is everybody else. We're really the nation of self-realization. It's just that it was able to plant here, and now we have a responsibility for it. There's a ton more that I could say, but I have 3 more weeks, okay? And I hope so do you. So if there are no questions, are there any questions or comments? If not, we'll let it pass. Okay, God bless you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for sticking with me without a break. Okay, see you next week.